Thank you for tuning in to This Week in Startups, the day after the election. I know some of you are here to hide, some of you are here to celebrate, but everyone's welcome. We are going to talk to the CEO of Skydio, Jason. They've been in the news for running afoul of sanctions in China. They're an incredibly important American manufacturing company in the drone space. Lots to talk about there. Then we do have a quick look at what happened since the election results got called last night. We're going to talk about immigration and especially M&A and some other winners and losers that relate to the startup world. And then Jason put me to the task and said, Alex, go out there and find a whole bunch of different ways that search works today to put the upcoming Perplexity round up to $9 billion into context. So we got a packed freaking show today. It's going to be great.
This Week in Startups is brought to you by Oracle. Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI, is a single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. Save up to 50% on your cloud bill at oracle.com/twist. Notion. Notion combines your notes, docs, and projects into one beautifully designed space with AI built right in. Try it for free at notion.com/twist. And Assembly AI. Get maximum value from voice data with Assembly AI. Build powerful products and features for your end users on the industry's leading speech-to-text models. Get 100 free hours to start building at assemblyai.com/twist.
All right, everybody. Welcome back to This Week in Startups. I'm your host, Jason Calacanis. With me again is Alex Wilhelm. It is November 6th. It's the big day, Alex. It's the day after the big election. How are you feeling, Alex, the day after?
I'm doing processing, but I do think that it's good that the results were clear. Forgetting who won, I think it's very constructive that there was a clear victory in the popular scenes and electoral college vote. I think that diminishes acrimony, tensions, and arguing about the election itself, and then we can get on to the policy questions. So that's good. That said, I did not vote for President Trump, and I have concerns about him on a policy and personal level. But here we are, and I guess I'm still kind of just digesting all the numbers, expected policy positions. We have a lot of that on the show today, Jason, but I'm curious, how do you feel?
I felt this was going to be a close race. I thought it would be closer, to be honest. I had problems with both candidates. I made that very clear to everybody. Not a fan of socialism. I felt one candidate was pretty much in the socialism camp, maybe moving to becoming a moderate. I don't like authoritarianism either. And so I was looking for a different candidate. But now that the country has picked their winner, I think it's critically important that everybody get behind that person and support them, and let's hope for the best that, you know, and that's where I'm really hoping that the people Trump listens to include our friends, Elon, Sachs, Chamath, et cetera, people around them, and that they actually do something productive, which would be to lower spending. I think there were two existential things I was actually worried about. One is spending. That's by far my number one. And number two is censorship and overreach by the state, whether it's breaking into somebody's home and confiscating their squirrel and euthanizing it, or policing speech and going after freedom of speech. None of that stuff I like. But that was a distant number two. And I feel like both those issues might get addressed by Trump in a positive way. And so I will hope for the best here. I'm very disturbed, though, about, you know, some of the deportation stuff, just on a practical basis.
Yeah, we're going to get into that in a little bit.
I'm super excited to get to work here, so let's do it.
All right, Adam Bry is the CEO and co-founder of Skydio, a drone company, Jason, that was famous back in the day for building really cool consumer drones that followed you around and took video. They were awesome. My friend Kyle worked there. And now the company has pivoted more towards the enterprise, working with governments in defense context and with corporations, and they've raised more than $500 million. So please, welcome to the show, Adam Bry.
All right. Nice to see you, Adam. How are you doing?
Doing well. Great to be here.
So maybe for the audience, just explain what Skydio does and what's happened here.
So we make autonomous drones. They're basically flying sensor platforms, and we serve critical industries. So we sell to public safety, we sell to defense, we sell to critical infrastructure operators, energy utilities, and our products basically enable them to get a real-time digital picture of things that they care about. So they're very easy to fly. You can deploy them in a few seconds. You can use them to inspect a cell tower or power plant, or you can use them to respond to 911 calls. And one of the things that I'm most excited about, and this is a market that's rapidly accelerating, is the use of drones in public safety, where you have drones that live in network-connected charging base stations. We call them docks. They could be on top of a fire station, on top of a police station. You distribute them across the city, and then you can get on scene in a matter of seconds after there's an emergency or an incident. And the drone can provide better information to first responders. And we're seeing this really accelerate across the nation. And it's transformative for public safety. It keeps communities safer. It keeps officers safer. It increases transparency and accountability in policing. And I think it's one of these things where, you know, drones, so we started Skydio in 2014. There was a huge wave of hype and excitement around the technology 10 years ago. It's kind of been this like 10-year overnight success where there's been this steady build for a long time. But we're finally at the moment where the autonomy technology is good enough. The hardware and the software is all there. And you can really start to deploy these things at scale to in many ways, transform the way the physical industries that we all depend on work.
And there are a couple of things, Alex, I remember, you know, having been tracking Adam's company for a long time here. There are a couple of unique things about your solution. One is you need to have a housing for drones if they're going to be truly autonomous. I have a drone. I've got a DJI on the shelf over here. I use it, but I have to set it up. I have to turn it on. I have to make sure it's charged. I have to swap the batteries out. There is a long list of things that I need to do before the drone goes out and does its work. If you're using Skydio, you have a landing pad that does inductive charging, that manages the drone on the roof of, a police station or a building like a Walmart, or if there was a solar array, there might be like a shed or something where this thing exists. And then it can take off and do autonomous flying. That is the product in terms of the key features, correct?
That's exactly right. We sell drones without the dock, and there's all kinds of exciting uses that we can talk about there. I mean, these things are critical on the battlefield as well, where you're probably less likely to have docks. But the dock is really the key to full automation. And one of the analogies that I use, it's kind of like a cloud server or something. Like all of us use cloud servers all the time without thinking about it, right? They're just in the background doing useful work for us. And that's what docks do for drones. You can have these things existing. They can be flying themselves on a schedule, automated missions, and you're just interacting with it through a phone or through the web browser. And so it becomes a purely software-defined experience, which is just incredibly powerful for all the different things you can do with drones. All the sort of physical friction is gone. And it's an automated device that just lives out there and does useful work.
So, Adam, about that, your analogy to cloud services, I think, is really great. But one thing that I like about cloud services is that I rent them. I don't have to own them. And so when you make that analogy, to me, it implies a future in which we have Skydio drones inside their little homes out and around the world that I can just effectively lease by the minute. Is that the direction you're going in?
So it's a really interesting idea. It's certainly something to think about. And I think that's a not unlikely future scenario. I mean, the instances where we're seeing this happen the fastest and the first is kind of shared infrastructure for cities, where, you know, for a city, you can have a shared network of drones that are responding to 911 calls, they're responding to fires, but they're also inspecting buildings and monitoring city infrastructure and monitoring coastline. It's a really, really powerful tool.
Could you tell me about the number of drones we need? So I live in about a million person town, and I'm just curious, to have shared drones for just public services, fire, police, et cetera, is that dozens? Is that hundreds? I don't have a good idea of how many we'd need to cover the city effectively.
Yeah, well, it depends on how many different kinds of incidents or events you want to respond to. What really drives it is volume. It's, people sort of tend to think in terms of area of like one drone can cover a few square miles. But what really drives it when you get into it is volume. So like in the context of policing, how many calls for service are you getting? So, you know, round numbers, the U.S. has 240 million calls for service per year. One drone annually can respond to something like 2000 calls per service. So, you know, a city with a population of a million people, you're talking about, a couple hundred drones to cover it completely. You don't need to start there. You can do useful work smaller than that, but that's the sort of order of magnitude.
All right, let's talk about AI, everybody. It's everywhere. Self-driving cars, breakthrough medical research, and of course, business tools that make everybody better and faster at their jobs. If AI hasn't hit your industry yet, trust me, it is on the way, and it's happening fast. But AI requires a ton of computing power. You know that. And those costs will skyrocket if you're not careful. I have seen these bills come in. It can get crazy quick. And that's why it's time for you to upgrade to the next generation of cloud. And that means Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is a blazing, fast, and secure platform that covers all the bases. Infrastructure, databases, app development, and of course, all your startups' AI and machine learning needs. Now here's the kicker. OCI costs 50% less for compute and 80% less for network compared to other cloud options. That's a lot of savings, especially when every minute counts in the cloud. Thousands of businesses have already upgraded to OCI, including MGM Resorts, Specialized Bikes, and Fireworks AI. So here's your call to action. Right now, if you switch to OCI, Oracle is offering to cut your current cloud bill in half for new U.S. customers with minimum financial commitment. But you'll need to act fast. The offer ends December 31st, 2024. See if your company qualifies for this special offer at oracle.com/twist. Oracle.com/twist. For people who don't know, your firm is the largest producer of drones in the United States. Domestically, you are now the largest producer. Is that correct?
That's correct, yeah. I mean, there's different categories. People are making toy drones, but for this class of sort of like enterprise-grade flying sensor platform, we're the largest producer by a pretty wide margin.
And the drones consist of, obviously, the motors and the propellers. You have GPS, you've got a computer on it. There's a lot of different components there.
Yeah.
And most people are buying drones like I did from a company called DJI. Are they the 800-pound gorilla in the space?
They are, yeah.
And this is a Chinese-based company from what I understand?
It is, yeah.
How should we feel about that in America? We're talking about drone warfare, and then we'll dovetail or back into your issue. We have a company like DJI producing drones here in the United States. Is that a healthy relationship for the United States to have, given that people believe now that drones are going to be a vector for terrorist attacks or just generally attacks, and they're being used in warfare, obviously, in Ukraine?
Yeah. So there's a little bit of interesting historical context here. So drones, if you called out the key components of drone, and a simple mental model to think about it is it's basically like the components that go into a cell phone smashed together with a quadcopter, so like four motors. That's, you know, high level, that's kind of what we're doing. You know, you've got compute, you've got wireless, you've got cameras, and then you've got this on the frame of a quadcopter. Historically, radio control toys and phones are all made in China. And so China, from a hardware perspective, got out to a pretty substantial lead starting like 15 years ago. And the sort of first wave of predominantly manually flown drones were almost all made in China. And DJI was the big winning company there. What's happened over the last decade is that these things that started off looking like consumer toys have just become critical tools for all these critical industries. And as that has happened, it's become increasingly clear as the geopolitical tension with China has gone up, that it's very risky to be depending on China for these products that are critical to national security, that, you know, are used for public safety, that are used on the battlefield. I mean, it's very much dual use technology. You can see this super clearly in Ukraine, but this sort of civilian class quadcopter is being used at very, very high volumes on the battlefield. And ultimately, you know, you can see this in other categories of technology as well. You know, the products that come out of China tend to align with Chinese foreign policy and Chinese national interests.
Shockingly enough. I'm curious, though, about Skydio and Chinese manufacturing kind of going back in time. So I know you guys are now the largest manufacturer of drones in the U.S. for your class, but was that always the case? Or was there a history at the company of using Chinese manufacturing lines that have now changed?
So we, from the very early days, we did all of our manufacturing in the U.S. So we have a global supply chain, and we can talk about that. I'm sure, sure. We will. But from the very early days, we did all of our manufacturing in the U.S. From our first product onwards. And honestly, we didn't start doing that because of geopolitical concerns. We started doing that just because we felt like that was the way to build the best product. You know, like one of the things that people misunderstand about drones, it's much closer to building like a fighter jet or a spacecraft than people realize. I mean, this is like you've got aerodynamics and thermals and vibration and very extreme mass constraints. It's a really extreme engineering challenge. And just like most aerospace companies tend to be pretty closely coupled with manufacturing, So it is with the most successful drone companies. So we started doing manufacturing in the US basically so we could just have it down the street from where we were doing R&D. And we've kept doing it since. And it's become a really important strategic advantage for us. I mean, the customers that we serve, especially the military, this is something that they care a great deal about. And we were, I mean, we were swimming way upstream in 2016. You know, in 2016, people thought this was insane. Like, just go to China, find a factory there to build it. We didn't do it. We invested in building up the capacity in the US. And I'm very glad that we did. I think it's critical from a national security perspective.
Well, it also dovetails with the news that caught my eye from a couple of days ago that the Chinese Ministry of Foreign Affairs sanctioned three companies: Edge Autonomy Operations, Huntington Ingalls Industries, and Adam, a little company called Skydio. So on that point, any operational disruptions? I presume not, given what you just said, but wanted to ask. And two, how shocked was the company that it was singled out by the Chinese government for essentially getting out of China?
Yeah, so I should be clear. So we do all of our final assembly manufacturing in the US. We still have a network of global suppliers. Typically, all drone components come from China. Over the last 2 or 3 years, we've done an enormous amount of work to get our supply chain out of China because we anticipated this as a possibility. We still had one critical dependence, which was batteries. Mm-hmm. And so our batteries for our latest drones were coming from China. So that is a disruption to us. So we had, you know, we were bringing up parallel suppliers. We have now accelerated that work, and we anticipate being able to basically bridge the gap with inventory we have on hand. But it'll be probably next spring before we have a new battery vendor.
Yeah. So China doesn't want you to sell drones into Chinese companies or to American companies in China. That's what this is about.
Well, so the sanctions, the stated reason for the sanctions was selling drones to Taiwan. Now our first customer in Taiwan is the Taiwan Fire Department. So you can judge for yourself, what the ulterior motivations might be here. I mean, the other backdrop for this is that DJI, the leading Chinese company, faces increased pressure in the US. You know, there's legislation being considered that would essentially ban them from introducing new products into the US. I think it's plausible that this was a retaliatory effort by the Chinese government against that. And we've also gotten big enough now that we're competing with DJI successfully. We're taking market share away from them. And we're really the first US company to do so in the civilian markets. And so, I think there's kind of a trade war national security backdrop to this whole thing.
Well, this actually, I think, is a really interesting point. If you were to talk about, networking equipment, Huawei comes to mind. We don't allow Huawei in the West because we know that it would have backdoors for the CCP to be able to look at data and vice versa. I don't think they want Cisco equipment in China on their backbone looking at data. They understand it's a possible risk. Now we get to autonomous devices like self-driving cars and drones. We've already seen drones being used in this new battlefield in Ukraine and being highly effective, and you can make them yourself. If you were to go to Instructables, you can basically build a quadcopter, right? This is like hobbyists are doing this all the time. Those quadcopters, they have no rules on them. There's no geofencing. So if you wanted to put an armament on it, or bomb, whatever you wanted to do. So how, and then you have self-driving cars. Obviously with self-driving cars, somebody could take over a fleet and do bad things with them. Like, God forbid, we've seen, terrorist attacks where people drive cars through markets. You could do that with a fleet of them if they were hacked. So this is a new vector. How should we look at drones? Should we, in your mind, as Americans, as the West, just wholesale ban the use of or the importing of these drones from China because of the risk? What do you think the actual risk is here in terms of public safety?
So I think the thing that's really important to understand is that the industry is still very early. Like most people are familiar with drones in the context of like consumers and videographers and capturing cool video.
Yes.
And I think that I don't want to say that there's no risk there, but I think the risks are pretty low. But if you think about a future, and this is happening now, where these things become infrastructure, right? Where they're installed at like every power plant, every city has like hundreds of these things across the rooftop. They're all network connected. They're autonomous. They can be controlled remotely over the cloud. I mean, you know, I think it would be pretty insane to accept a future where all those things are Chinese products that are ultimately going to be, you know, tools of Chinese policy. Like, if you're concerned about Huawei routers, the idea of like network connected autonomous devices distributed across our critical infrastructure in US cities, like, there's not, you know, it just doesn't seem like a great idea. And so I think that's kind of the key distinction I would make, is like, it's looking towards the future, like, where is this technology going? And I think if you look at where it's going, it's untenable, in my view, to say that, like, you know, we want all this stuff to be made in China.
I want to ask more about that, because one thing I'm a little bit concerned about when it comes to an expansion of drones, something that in general I'm very bullish on, is the cybersecurity element, because it's great if drones are made in the US, we can control the supply chain, manufacturing, et cetera. But if they're still hackable, they're still in danger. So I'm kind of curious if you can tell me just a little bit about how Skydio approaches the cybersecurity element of this to make sure that drones at power plants literally don't go rogue.
Yeah, look, it's the two number one things for us are reliability and security. Those are the two things that make products useful for that kind of critical application. We basically do everything you can imagine up and down the stack. I mean, we do like secure boot, secure signing of our software at the root that we like control in our factory. We have our drones authenticate to our cloud in a secure way. We have all the internal processes and controls. We do everything that you need to do at every layer of the stack. Like, the link is encrypted. I mean, all the different things to be as secure as you possibly can.
Okay, one more on the defense point, and then I promise we'll wrap up here. But drones in Ukraine have been used for a host of things, from surveillance to literal combat missions. And I'm just kind of curious, is Skydio willing to make drone systems that are used for more than surveillance in conflict zones?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. So the U.S. military is a major customer. We've delivered to Ukraine. Our identity as a company is different from, say, a company like Anduril. Like, Anduril is pretty clear that, like, their goal, they're like a pure play defense contractor.
Yeah.
We're building, you know, people call it like dual use technology. Like, we're building this flying sensor platform that's useful for all these different kinds of industries and applications. But the military is an incredibly important customer of ours, and we are deeply committed to their mission. From a product perspective, I would say that we're focused on building flying sensor platforms. We know that you can attach payloads and other things to this. And we're supportive of whatever military customers need to do to accomplish their mission. And putting munitions on there, being able to drop these things, is certainly part of the portfolio for them. And that's something that we, you know, our platforms can support. Like, the X-10, our latest flagship drone, has payload bays, modular attachments. And I think this, I'm actually glad that you asked this. I think this is kind of like it's somewhat of a controversial topic in Silicon Valley. Like, how's this technology really going to be used? This is something we've thought deeply about as a company. And in my view, if you're going to sell to and support the military, you need to trust their judgment on how they're going to use these things. I mean, these are people who devote their lives to protecting our nation. They put their lives on the line. And I just don't think, like, us in Silicon Valley as technologists are in any position to say, like, oh, sure, you can use this, but, like, you know, no, you're not allowed to do it or something. Like, so that's the way that we think about it. Like, there's a different category of drone that's basically like a kamikaze drone. It's like a flying bomb, essentially. Yeah. It's pretty different from a technology perspective. That's not what we build. We're focused on building like best-in-class ISR systems.
Yeah. But Adam, my brother's active duty, so I care a lot about this because, you know, he's been in war zones and so forth. But there's a difference between, like, you know, winking at the army and saying, yeah, we'll put bays on it, and kind of doing it yourself. And I'm just curious, why not take that next step and do the work to turn them into more Anduril style weapons platforms? I mean, to me, it just seems like you're right there, but you're not taking that last step. And I'm just curious why.
I think it's they're kind of different technologies. I mean, even the folks who are building munitions, you know, it's like, there's a whole expertise in like building explosive devices and targeting systems and like how all that stuff works. And I think the product trade-offs are pretty different if you really want to build. I mean, like, I don't know, the video that Anduril put out got a lot of plays. Like, they built this thing that's like a terminal flight quadcopter. Like, there's a whole slew of product trade-offs that they made there that are pretty different. Our product is like better for what they call ISR, intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance. But X-10 was designed with payload bays for whatever missions customers need to do. And I would also say, like, philosophically, I think it's a different, you know, waking up every day, figuring out how you're going to make the thing like more lethal is like different from waking up every day to figure out how you're going to make the thing like better at responding to 911 calls. Like, I think you know, the mindset of like building something that's like the express purpose of it is to be like a lethal machine is somewhat different. And I think, you know, it's a little bit different from like our core DNA as a company.
Got it. Yeah, I think it makes total sense. And there are contractors who make Humvees, and there are contractors who make 50 caliber guns that go on Humvees. And yeah, there are different levels of expertise. And so, yeah, I see there being...
That's a good analogy.
I love Notion. I love it. I use it all day long. I have built my company around Notion. And every startup claims that when you add AI to a product, it's going to change everything. But Notion has actually done it. Our Twist team, we use Notion all day long. Databases, calendar, note-taking, even the ad reads. When I read ads here, I'm reading from a Notion page. And I love that my team has embraced it. When you introduce Notion into your company, everybody's going to feel less stressed because everything you do is documented. And when a new person joins the company or somebody has to learn a new task, they go to one of our playbooks that we've made internally. Now AI has taken that up a notch. You can search across all of Notion and your other apps inside of Notion, and then you can generate docs in your style, right? They'll also analyze the PDFs and images that you upload to Notion, and it'll chat with you about anything. So imagine everybody in your organization collecting knowledge, and then you have the ability, easy peasy lemon squeezy, to ask questions about that. It is brilliant. Notion is my favorite tool in the world right now. Keeps everything in one place. It makes me feel like our organization is not losing knowledge. And you know what? Sometimes people retire. I have this every year, you know, or two, I lose a great person because they move on to another adventure, or maybe they want a career change, or maybe they retire. And you're like, oh, what happened to all that knowledge? It's now saved in Notion. I want you to try Notion for free by going to notion.com/twist. That's it. All lowercase. notion.com/TWIST to try the most powerful, easy to use product for recording all of your data in one place. It is so magical. And you know what? I'm using it for everything. I have one for my personal family office. I have one for inside. We have one for all in. Everybody is using Notion. You don't want to lose data. You don't want to lose knowledge. Notion.com/twist. And when you use our link, they know you're supporting the show.
What do you think of Nova Sky Stories as we wrap here? My friend Kimball Musk has a company that like brings art to the skies, and we're seeing more and more of this. What are your thoughts on these drone shows and light shows? Do you guys participate in that? Because it does seem like that is a perfect analogy to what war might look like in the future. It's like 1,000 drones going out there.
Yeah. So we don't do that ourselves. The way that most of that stuff works, I mean, basically all of it works, it's using GPS. So it basically like it, all those drones have GPS on them. You can pre-script out the trajectory that all of them are going to fly. They fly around, they turn on and off the lights. GPS doesn't work at all on the battlefield. It's just always jammed. This is one of like the key lessons of the brain, which invalidates sort of the like the first layer of technology for most drones. This is so Skydio drones have a visual navigation system, so they don't need to rely on GPS. But I do think there is this fairly critical point here. I'm not the first person to make this observation, but every time that you see like a 10,000 drone light show in China, there is sort of this element to that of like, it's a display of power, right? It's a display.
I agree. That was my interpretation of it. Like they're sending a message to Taiwan that like 10,000 of these things could go over your city, identify people with guns, also known as soldiers, and just zip and kill, you know, 10,000 people with 10,000 drones. I think that is the future of warfare.
I think it's one of these things where you're getting a glimpse into like, oh boy, you know, this is really critical technology and we need to step on it in the US. You know, we need to have strong industry here. We need to have robust policies. We need to think about national security.
And have to have the ability to make every component, right? I mean, I think that's one of the challenges here. You're only as good as your slowest supplier. So if you've got like a component in these drones and you want to make 10,000 of them and you're getting your rotors from China or Vietnam and it's a Chinese manufacturer who has a factory in Vietnam, we could basically not be able to create drones and they can.
Yeah. So supply chain security integrity is super critical. You know, I don't think it necessarily all needs to be made in the US, but it's certainly having it within our circle of really trusted close allies.
Yes.
I think is very important.
This has been amazing. Congratulations on the success of the company, doing great work. And in some ways, congratulations on the Chinese government being so concerned about you that they sanctioned you for helping the fire department in Taiwan with putting out fires and helping.
Thank you guys for having me on. It's a conversation. We're proud to support Taiwan.
All right. And if you're an engineer, Skydio is hiring amazing engineers, I know. So go to the Skydio webpage and apply if you're a great engineer, right? You need some engineers, I think.
Yeah, I'm not neutral on this, but I think we work on the most exciting stuff in the world. You know, it's flying robots. It helps people do their jobs better. It keeps them safer. And a lot of exciting stuff happening now, but it's still very early days.
Yeah, it is. It's early days and it's super awesome. I'm waiting for somebody to make one of these for homes or ranches. And just keep, you know, track of the cattle and the...
Yeah, we get... So within the most requested feature with our investor community, which says something about investors, is the ranch use case. Yes. So I think the number of target customers there might be...
There's like five of us, six of us. Yeah. So making... This is the crazy thing for poor founders who have, you know, VCs on their board. They're like, you know what? I need this. Can you make me a $50,000 drone for my ranch to go do sorties and count my sheep and my steer? It's pretty crazy, but it's super awesome. And
we'll get you some sheep counting drones for your ranch, Jake.
Eventually, it's going to be a thing where I think people will have these on the top of their homes, right? Yeah.
I agree. I think that, it's like classic technology deployment. Like, we're starting in the highest value, highest impact scenarios, like 911 calls, life and death situations, inspecting the energy grid. But like, you know, our costs will keep coming down. The technology keeps getting better. And I think there's a very clear path to this becoming like a standard part of building security, standard part of armed security.
I mean, anywhere where you have to cover a large surface area and, you know, record what's going on. I was just thinking ski season's coming. And I was just watching this incredible documentary on Netflix about this tragic avalanche that happened in Palisades, the ski resort in Tahoe. It happened in the 80s, and it was just real tragedy. And we had another one happen, an avalanche where a couple of people passed away, sadly, just last season.
Yeah.
And one of the things you have to do is they literally shoot mortars, Alex, at the mountain to start avalanches when there's too much. And this... crazy documentary that I watched, it's well worth watching, because there are these people who do the science of mountaineering and monitoring these mountains. It's something that started at this specific place in Tahoe, and sending drones out to test the snow, to monitor the snow, to know the differences in snow and where snow is building up, and then also to drop a grenade essentially in certain areas to start avalanches means a person doesn't need to do that mission, and that's just going to be better for everybody.
Yeah, it's pretty closely related. Like any sort of natural disaster, like in the wake of the hurricanes, the two recent hurricanes, drones are like the most critical tools. Like we have a bunch of customers in Florida, and after Milton, I mean, they had drones in the air, like multiple drones in the air, 24/7. Like initially, it's search and rescue, and then you're helping to like map and assess the damage. And I think it's another one of these sort of glimpses like you get in Ukraine, where it's just like, oh my goodness, this technology can make such a big difference in the high stakes scenarios. And it's exciting. Having been working on it for 10 years, it's exciting to be at a point now where it's
and like, some of them have the ability with a payload that you could actually rescue a human.
You can drop a flotation device. You can drop a battery. Actually, one of the most common, this is a little bit surprising to me. In search and rescue, one of the most common things they want to drop is a battery, because people have their phone, but they ran out of battery. So you drop a battery charger down to them and they can get back online and communicate.
Fantastic. So there's all kinds of stuff like that. And some of them I've seen people get lifted in a drone, right? Some of them are powerful enough that you could actually lift somebody out of a dangerous situation. I'm wondering when that will happen for lifeguards. Why would a lifeguard go out into, or a Coast Guard go out into this open ocean when they could send a drone with a buoy and just drag the person in?
Yeah, I mean, there's really just a continuum from drones up to the like eVTOLs.
I was just about to say that. Yeah, absolutely.
It's kind of the same ingredients. It's like electric propulsion, autonomy, automation. And I think, I mean, unsurprisingly, like you're going to see drones reach massive scale first, but there's non-trivial sort of technology crossover there. Like basically, you build a bigger drone. Yeah.
Yeah, the drones to save, the drone rescue swimmers are definitely coming. And the documentary, Buried, the 1982 Alpine Meadows Avalanche, is the name of that one, if you want to watch it. Alpine Meadows eventually became Palisades, and then was called Squaw, I think, for a little while. All right. Great having you on the program, Adam, and continued success. If you're an engineer, go apply at Skydia. Well done.
All right. Thank you, guys.
It really is amazing, Alex, when you think about watching this technology. You and I have been watching drones. We've been watching VR. We're now watching AI. You watch these technologies and they go through a cycle, right, where they are absolutely capture everybody's imagination. And then founders need to basically work a decade to make an actual use case exist. And what I love about what Adam's doing at Skydio is you heard in there an incredible piece of startup advice. I don't know if you heard it when he dropped it, but it is, what is the highest use of this technology? Where is the most acute situation? Paul Graham called it, I think, hair on fire situation. Like,
yes.
if you're selling buckets of water and somebody's hair is on fire, they really need it. Some people refer to this as the vitamin versus a painkiller. Vitamin's a big business, but like, yeah, if you take your vitamins today, or if you don't, you might forget. It's no big deal. But if you have pain and you broke your leg, man, that Vicodin, you're going to seek it out if you've, really need it. And they just work backwards. Hey, we know people in the military need to assess situations. They may have to drop payload or pick up payload, whatever it is. The sending a burrito is already covered. You know, like getting your burrito by a drone is an $8 burrito, a $15 service charge. It doesn't actually make sense. And so many times founders come to me, Alex, with like, I want to start with the masses. I want to start. And sometimes it's really good intentions. Like, oh, I just think everybody should have this technology. Go after the most expensive, highest margin business first. Why? Those customers are hair on fire customers who have money and they're willing to pay a premium, which then allows you to iterate on the software and then eventually get to the rescue swimmer, which there might only be the need for 1,000 rescue swimmer drones or 10,000. So you don't go after that first. And those people are, comparing it to a $20 an hour lifeguard. It's not as much a stake as like a Black Hawk helicopter with Navy SEALs, which are, I think, valued by our military at about $10 to $25 million for each Navy SEAL. If you save a Navy SEAL from dying, the way the government looks at that, not just the human life, but the cost of that asset, as my friends in the military would say, is like, I had a friend who was a Green Beret. He's like, I'm worth $12 million currently. My friend's worth $22 million. Depending on if you're a medic or, whatever you are. So,
no, I really like, I'm very optimistic about drones writ large. I'm very optimistic about Skydio and have been watching the technology for a long time, to your point. It's just very exciting to see how things go 1, 2, 4, 8, and then 1,000, because drones were something that I think we all had too long in the consumer bucket, and the number of military and corporate uses are so large. Frankly, I'm very excited about Skydio. I'm a little surprised though, Jason, they're valued at like $2.3 billion in their last round, which just feels very small for a company with that large of a footprint and is already causing geopolitical waves, yeah?
Hardware is hard. So, I really always tip my hat off to hardware founders because, you have to inventory stuff. You have to prototype stuff. And with software, there's no inventory in the software business. And if you make software and it's janky, just rewrite the code. Start from scratch. Fire the developers. Hire two new developers. Do it in parallel. Make three versions of the same feature with three different teams. In hardware, you cannot do that. It's cost prohibitive.
Absolutely.
And you have to go through a very grinded out process, as I learned with CafeX, with density.io, which is doing people counting. I've made these bets and my Lord, I have another one, FreeDrum, which is like drumming sticks that teach you how to drum. It's very cool. These poor founders have to deal with the Kickstarter elements of what they do and then scaling it. And man, if you have a production problem, you could be sitting on inventory. You have customers who want to buy it and like one supplier screws something up and literally you're as fast as your slowest and least reliable person. This, I think, will dovetail nicely into the Trump discussion and our country and relationship with China.
Yeah, yeah. That's why I'm so glad we had the Skydio CEO on, because we're literally looking at a situation in which there is a American company dealing with a geopolitical tension that is driven by decisions made by administrations.
If your startup has any voice data, and I'm sure you do, Assembly AI is going to help you catch up fast. They have powerful, ready-to-go speech-to-text modules that are going to make it easy to turn your data into features that your users are going to love without a massive investment. It's very simple. You just take a few lines of code and then you start building. Take Veed.io, for example. They use Assembly AI's models to auto-generate captions for their video tools. And they use Assembly AI to put captions on that. What a great idea. And why would you rebuild that? No, you want to have a partner like Assembly AI, because their models are accurate and they're lightning fast and they're delivered at the industry's lowest word error rate. Plus, you're going to get 30% fewer hallucinations. This is what software is all about. One company saying, we're going to make this perfect so that all the other companies don't have to reinvent the wheel. So go to assemblyai.com/twist for 100 free hours and join over 200,000 developers who are using voice data to create amazing apps. What will you think of? Think of all the talking we do, phone calls, podcasts, huddles, Zoom calls. Just think of all of that opportunity being inside of your app, and go to assemblyai.com/twist to get 100 hours process free and let yourself dream of new features to delight your customers.
To let everyone understand what happened last night, Trump, former president, won the White House. His party took over the Senate. And it's looking pretty good in the House as we come here today. We don't actually know who's going to win the House, but it's looking GOP if you track prediction markets and so forth. And as Jason said at the top of the show, I think it was about 51.5, 47.5, which in American terms is a shellacking. This was
that
not
is the technical term, is a shellacking.
Yes. Yeah. So 2 points is normal. 1 point's close. 4 points is a lot, is how to kind of think about that.
A reaming. Yes. They got trounced. And so if we look at it, I think, you know, it does beg the question, why? Why was this such an incredible victory for Trump? And, you know, if I look at it, there's many layers here. I think a lot of this comes back to entrepreneurship. And maybe it's just the glasses I look at it, but I do think there is an existential battle in America right now. And if you were to look at Europe, very socialist leaning, you know, maybe less entrepreneurial, less rabid capitalism, you know, is the version over there. And then here we have a capitalist system, which is very hard driving, and it does create a polarization of wealth. And I think one party picked, we're going to go pro-entrepreneur, we're going all in with Elon, with Sachs, with Chamath, with entrepreneurship, with venture capital, and they picked a venture capitalist as their number two. And they picked a billionaire capitalist as their number one. So putting aside how I personally feel about Trump, I have issues with character, which I think trust me, my friends who are the biggest Trump supporters in the world have problems with his character. And they've been public about the problems they have with his character. They put all that aside. And if we just look, career politicians on one side and capitalists on the other, that's what happened here. And I think people, because the personalities are so large, Alex, people kind of get caught up in that. But putting aside the personality issues and the style issues, which in some cases are absolutely abhorrent on one side, and that I'm not a fan of. I don't like the name calling, et cetera. But let's just pause for a second here. Billionaire, real estate tycoon, and venture capitalist beat a lifelong public two lifelong public servants. That, I think, is what we as the technology community, venture capital, and as Americans should really look at. And then they enlisted Elon, and he seems to have pushed a lot of young men to vote, a group that previously hadn't voted. And I don't know if that's come out in the statistics yet, but that's what I was hearing, since I have a lot of friends on the inside, was that, hey, there's going to be a change here in the activation of young men who are capitalist, entrepreneurial, and not part of this previous group, you know, I'll say, in the social side. So that's the argument that I think is worth considering. What's your take, Alex?
I think that is a very, that's one point of view you could take. I think it was inflation and a long period of spending in low interest rates across parties that caught up to us, and the party that was in office when inflation took off lost. That's my read. You're talking about nuance and policy and such, and I just don't think that carries amongst the broader electorate the way it does amongst our highly educated, wealthy group of friends out there.
Yeah, interesting.
Average folks are pretty dumb and pretty poor.
Yeah, there is that. But I do think they look at these folks as heroes. And I think they looked at one group as aspirational and one group maybe as not aspirational. That's just my gut, but maybe I could be wrong.
I would like to wait until we have a little bit more data before I make any strident kind of points about this. I mean, what is clear is that Trump did better amongst people of color, both genders. And young men did shoot to the right a little bit, just as college-educated women shunted to the left.
It seems like everybody moved to the right. There was a very interesting image I tweeted. And Trump has increased his support across the electorate. Republican margin over Democrats changed since 2020 by demographic group. And this just shows very simply what percentage shifted Republican versus shifted Democrat. And if you look at white collar, if you look at just the arrows here, what you'll see here is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, I think it's 14 different demographics, age, ethnicity, and gender. There are two groups that shifted more Democrat. 65-year-olds and above.
Yep.
And white college women. And then the other 12 all shifted to varying degrees Republican. And the size of the arrow is how far they shifted. And the three groups that shifted the most were Hispanic, Asian, and 18 to 29-year-olds. That is stunning. Those are the people who would normally associate with Democrats. They made the biggest move to the Republican Party, along with 30 to 44-year-olds. There are other groups that are de minimis. They could have gone either way. So what are your thoughts on that, Alan?
I think a lot of people were surprised at the scale of this. Well, I mean, it's everyone. I've been reading a lot of Twitter, as you have been, since we started seeing results come in. And what I find very impressive is that everyone thinks that they were right about what should have been done, or why they won, or why they lost. So I don't think people are really learning a lot about this. I'm very curious to see later on some deeper polling about views on gender and how that may have impacted this particular election.
Yep.
I think the divergence from Biden to Harris's results with not that much policy difference makes me wonder a little bit. But I also think the Democratic Party needs a new set of leadership, because 100%. clearly the Biden-Pelosi era is over and they're getting their ass kicked.
Big time.
It doesn't seem like they know what they're doing. So I think it's time for a house clearing. But I suppose I'm trying to sort out some dissonance, Jason, and I want you to help me with this. Because when the Trump victory went from likely to, okay, this is happening, the stock market in the U.S. began to pick up steam. And so today, before we hit record, just so everyone knows, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was up 3 points, new 52-week high, S&P up 2 points, NASDAQ up 2 points. Clearly, a lot of ebullience in the market about the next Trump administration. And Jason, we're going to talk about immigration in terms of high skill and M&A in a second. But the thing that I don't understand, Jason, is the dissonance between everyone in the business community not wanting extreme tariffs on Mexico, China, and the world at large, and the Trump policy to do that. And so what I don't understand is, was Trump lying the whole time? Or do your friends on the inside think that he's actually going to do these very inflationary tariff moves right away, as you promised?
Absolutely. This is one of the things that breaks intelligent people's brains with Trump. I have now, having so many people close to Trump, and having interviewed J.D. Vance and spoken to folks, you know, in public and in private, Trump says insane things. He gets massive amounts of attention for saying things that are either, you know, is literally having a talk with a young person about this. Like, they're like, is that what he said racist? I'm like, it's kind of like racist adjacent, you know, when he says Mexico sends all their terrible people to America. Is that literally racist, or is it factual that he sends, you know, that Mexico sent criminals here because they don't want to have to deal with them, and they didn't send like their CEOs over here across the border? So when he says he's going to deport 15 million people, and then Bannon says, yes, Bannon said on the All In live stream last night, confirming, yes, that's like job number one. Now, Bannon's not part of the Trump administration, nor do I think they're going to let him in again. But I do think that is part of what you're identifying here is Trump will say something that is absolutely outlandish, impractical, and then it's up to people around him to execute on some version of it. And I think the version that we'll see specifically with immigration, and we should start with that one, I think, and then we'll go to tariffs. I think with immigration, he's going to deport people who beat up police or who are fentanyl dealers or criminals, and then let the other 14.x million of the 15 stay here.
So I just want to be clear. The people, because this is useful for me to know, Jason, because you have very different friends in terms of their political alignment than I do, mostly. And that's not a diss, by the way, just kind of a factual statement. I mean,
they were almost all Democrats, 5 years ago. So
No. I said that, and then it sounded like I was being pejorative. Mm. I was just trying to point out that you're hearing different things. So I want to double click on them. They think, based on their knowledge of Trump, his policies and the election and the campaign, that much of what he promised that you and I would consider to be bad for the economy, tariffs, you know, a labor shortage, et cetera, won't happen. They'll be cut down to a much smaller size, sounds like, with the
correct.
Some deeper. Okay. Yeah, well, that's a bet.
He exaggerates. So if you interpret Trump as lying or exaggerating, I think is the journey people go through. He is like some P.T. Barnum exaggerator in order to make points. We're going to smash him. I'm going to go in there and I'm going to, the war in Ukraine will be over in, you know, the day I come into office. He will say something bombastic, maybe crazy, maybe people will interpret as a lie. And basically, the way people who are in and around Trump interpret everything he says is he's going to put the goalposts and the target, you know, like I'm going to shoot for the moon, I'm going to shoot for the stars and get the moon kind of situation. And so I think let's just meditate on immigration here.
Yeah.
We had him on All In. Here's the clip from All In where I asked President Trump about immigration and high skilled immigration specifically. Roll the tape.
What I want to do and what I will do is you graduate from a college. I think you should get automatically as part of your diploma, a green card to be able to stay in this country. And that includes junior colleges, too. Anybody graduates from a college, you go in there for 2 years or 4 years. If you graduate or you get a doctorate degree from a college, you should be able to stay in this country.
Okay.
So when he said that, the question is he pandering to me and to the business community by extension or not? And what happened was after that quote, his group around him backtracked it a bit and said, this is only for high skilled, only for PhDs. This is not for people crossing the border, et cetera. But I do think that the influence around him are going to say, we need to get more high skilled immigrants in here while shutting the border. Here's Steve Bannon, the architect of MAGA, who literally put a bunch about it last night on the All In live stream, talking about specifically when I asked him, hey, tell me about immigration. And you believe he should start deporting millions of illegal immigrants?
All 15 million. I'm adamant about it. You can start with the quote unquote the same asylums. You can start with the criminals. You can do all that. But eventually, because here's the thing, you either have a country or you don't. This is crushing opportunities for African-American and Hispanic men. This is what that vote was about. Now the Congressional Budget Office is telling us that if you deport them, you're going to knock off 1% of GDP. Well, I don't care about knocking off 1% of GDP. These people are taking opportunities from American citizens.
All right. So there you have Trump saying to a business audience, hey, you know, we're going to get high-skilled immigrants in here. And then the other side,
Steve Bannon, who doesn't work for the administration, just to be clear, I think they will disavow him. But I asked J.D. Vance the same question about this issue, right, Alex? And he said, we're going to do it like a sandwich. We'll take a couple of bites and, you know, we're not going to try to eat the sandwich in one bite. I think the reality is they're not going to deport 15 million people.
What's your over under on how many get deported? If you had to, like, you know, crystal ball
No, if we did a prediction market right now, and I think the prediction markets is a really good topic for us today as well, is just how great the prediction markets were at assessing what was going on here. Shout out to Polymarket, Robinhood. I think they did. They got it right.
You know, they were, I mean, in October, I looked this up this morning because there's been a lot of crowing about the accuracy of prediction markets. Like a week ago, the prediction markets gave Trump essentially no chance of winning the popular vote. So I do think they're very good at incorporating real time information, but they're not as good at prognostication. And that's the mistake people are making. I bring it up because I don't want people to not understand that point.
I wouldn't blindly find any, but I do think they did a better job net than, let's say, pollsters or pundits, generally speaking. I don't think any pollster or pundit said Trump's going to win the popular vote. Like, that was like a way out there. And nor did they think he would sweep this. I mean, did he sweep the swing states? No,
seven out of eight. But by the way,
Polymarket, pretty close. What didn't he win? Which one didn't he win? I'm curious if you know.
Just to be clear, Polymarket as recently as, like, you know, 4 weeks ago had Kamala winning. So just
The popular.
No, the election.
Oh, really? Dip down there? Okay.
Polymarket pulled up right here. This is the thing. People are really obsessing about Polymarket being about half an hour ahead of the networks calling the election. And to be clear, shout out. That's legitimate and useful. But they've been very wrong for a long period of time about the thing people are claiming they were always right about. And that's bothering me a little bit because I have the charts and I've been tracking them for months. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I'm trying to remember when Kamala had a lead. I think it was like right after the 2 weeks after they hot swapped Biden, right? That was when she peaked for a lead. There was like this little, you know, honeymoon period, and then it just went straight down.
I'm just going to pull it up so everyone can see it here. Screen sharing. Because there's two, this is the thing, there's actually two different times in which Kamala was, I don't know, oh boy.
Well, I mean, if in, yeah, when there she did.
So 2 points, go, yeah. Right here, 53%. And then also she took over again right that? There.
I'm curious.
This is September 22nd. Through the end of September, and then there. And then just to be clear, the popular vote, which I think is important to see, as recently as September and October, Donald Trump was, you know, not picked to win
no
it.
No chance.
This is useful because it was ahead of the election, the rest of the world. But as of, you know, 20 minutes ago, they weren't saying that.
Yeah. So that is, I think, instructive as well, that these things are not going to be perfect, but they're part of the overall package. So the question, your question to me, though, if I was going to set up a prediction market over under 1 million, right? So let's just say deportation over under 1 million, I'm taking under a million. What would you take? That he'll deport under a million.
I mean, gun to my head, I'd say over. The thing that I struggle with.
So you take it seriously. Okay.
Well, no. 15 million would be taking it seriously. Listening to Bannon would be taking it seriously. The thing that I struggle with Trump is that when people contextualize his behaviors, promises, and actions, it comes down to, I think that the people who know him will influence him in a certain direction.
Yeah.
And while I do think that your friends Sachs and Schmath and so forth and so forth will have influence, so too will the more reactionary right, the less pro-business right. Bannon said in that clip, he doesn't care about 1% GDP. Yeah. 1% GDP is a lot of money. And so I'm curious to see who Trump will actually listen to. If it is your friends,
I'm going to guess it's going to be the business people, but I could be wrong. I think this is a key thing. So who he puts into his cabinet will be the ultimate tell this time around.
Yeah.
And so if you want to understand if he's going to listen to Elon, Sachs, Chamath, Peter Thiel, J.D. Vance, because sometimes people don't even listen to their VPs. If it's going to be a tech-driven agenda, a pro-business agenda, or if it's going to be a pro-isolationist tariff agenda, I think is the thing we should be monitoring. Yeah,
and to me, there's always been that dissonance between the two sides, and I have not been able to understand it, unless the people who are very excited about Trump and who are on the tech side of things think that they have more influence than the people who do want to do a 15 million person deportation. I don't know. I don't know Trump.
I think he likes to be liked. He likes money. Yes. And he likes not going to jail. Like, I think him winning. he got to remember, he now gets to press a button and cancel, you know, a number of the legal actions against him. So independent, if you think it's lawfare or fair law, he needed to win order to not go to jail or to erase the final. I think he's got 3 cases outstanding. So there's 3 cases plus 1 sentencing. I think all that he's going to be able to make disappear and use, you know, the presidency to either push those off or to cancel those actions against him. So
yeah.
He needed to win. So if we just think from first principles, I do think he likes business. He likes being liked. He likes building business relationships. And he doesn't need to win again.
No, he doesn't need to win again. But let's do the over-under again on high-skilled immigration, because that clip, that was based off a question you asked Trump during an all-in interview. And it was actually one of the very few times in which I was like, I agree with Trump on a thing.
Yeah,
I was
very
excited about it. I was like, this is perfect. I would go a step further and give people citizenship, but hey, green cards are fine. So, Jason, high-skilled immigration in the U.S., 4 years from the start of the next Trump administration, in percentage terms, how much does it go up or down?
Gonna go up high-skilled immigration at least 25%.
Okay.
At least. Yeah, I would say he's going to make good on that promise. I think he will make good on a series of business promises. And this just sounds cutthroat, but I think he cares about money and business connections above anything else now that he's won. I think his motivation was to win, to, you know, prove that he could do it again and to get rid of the lawfare or fair law, the lawsuits. So it was existential for him to win. Now that he's won, I bet he's playing for legacy and money and power post getting out. In other words, he's a businessman. So what would be in his best interest? To have incredible relationships with the business community. And I think the MAGA community, like I'll call the hard MAGA, like not financial MAGA, but Steve Bannon MAGA, like isolationist MAGA. I think that that's going to wane. I think that's going to be less his priority. I think he uses those people and that shtick to get into office. Just like he used the evangelicals, you know, and the abortion issue to win the primaries the first time around. And then he soft stepped that back and said, listen, you know, I'm pro IVF. I'm pro these exceptions. Right. So he.
Well, what he did was essentially reform the Supreme Court to be incredibly conservative, and especially packed with people whose religious tradition is opposed to a lot of social issues that are important. So I think he did more than you're giving him credit for there in terms of fulfilling his promises. But one place where there does seem to be consensus about what a second Trump administration will look like is, Jason, your favorite thing.
Oh,
it's
no.
The world of M&A.
And, oh, great. I thought you were going to say crypto. M&A is going to be fantastic. All M&A right. is on. This is, people were like, J-Cal, cry more. And I'm like, I told you all I'm not voting for Kamala. I told you I'm not a fan of socialism and I wasn't a fan of how she was anointed. I am thrilled with this aspect of the Trump second term, which is M&A is going to be on like a Donkey Kong. They might, in the perfect situation, Alex, might be they don't let M&A with the top 5 companies, which J.D. Vance and Trump don't like, Facebook, Amazon, Apple. They might give them a hard time while letting everybody else run amok and do whatever they want, which is exactly what I've been proposing.
Okay. But you just said something super illustrative, Jason.
Yeah.
You just said that Trump and JD don't like them.
And like
you just described their essentially antitrust policy based on who they like, which is very much not rule of law.
I don't think it's personal. They don't like the censorship and the power that Facebook has had in previous elections. Now, that's why you saw Zuckerberg say like, wow, man, you know, Trump was awesome when he, you know, got shot and got up and said, fight, fight, fight. You remember that? Zuck just magically all of a sudden came out that was, what do you say, badass or something?
Well, so yes. Maybe all get our ears nicked. I mean,
that's why he came out and said badass.
And that's why Bezos this morning called Trump's election like astounding or whatever he did. They're all ass kissing. I just would prefer a world in which business leaders didn't feel the need to publicly bend the knee to a political leader. That's not the dynamic that I think is healthy. And I think if you go back to the first Trump administration, people forget this. There was it a Time Warner AT&T merger in the book that they were trying to do? And yep. Trump was trying to kill it off because he didn't like CNN. The pettiness of these people will play into M&A. Maybe. And I do think it's going to be better, but it's not going to be perfect.
No, I think Lena Khan's done. And I think they will let anybody who supports them and supports the Republican Party do what they want. I think that they will be bought and paid for.
Isn't that not good?
I mean, no system is perfect. I'm being a pragmatist, you know.
I think
whoever supports you to get in office, whether it's with votes or with donations, is going to have an outsized voice in our political system. And we consider the spending part of freedom of speech, right? Political spending on PACs, super PACs, or just support running fundraisers, whether you support Obama, Hillary, Kamala, or Trump, is part of the entire package, is trying to have influence, right?
Yeah, but I just don't like that. I think influence in politics should not be predicated on net worth.
That is a valid concern after what we saw this election. The Democrats spent $1 billion, I heard, on ads. And then obviously you had 5 or 6 folks on the Republican side, including Elon and Jeff Yass and everything, 50 to 150 million each. So yeah, I mean, I think as a society need to think, should there be this much money involved? And I liked your suggestion, which other countries do, which is they just give a budget to the final 2 or 3 candidates. Here's your budget to spend. That seems like a better idea to me.
If you go through the Trump platform, actually public funding of elections is cited by name as something that he will refuse. Wow.
Look at this. Harris and Trump spent nearly $10 billion on ads. $10 billion for the U.S. presidency.
I saw some of these.
Problematic.
Did you see the World Series, the baseball?
No, I did not watch the World Series.
One of my friends is a huge Yankees fan, so I got roped into it. So I sat down and watched live baseball for one of the games, and I saw more political ads than I thought was humanly possible. And I gotta say, I don't think any of that money that was spent on me that evening was a good use of cash. And I really do think that buying blocks of broadcasting cable news to promote your candidate is just a very 2000 era strategy, Jason. It feels very archaic in this moment. But back to M&A, really quick. People are stoked about this. Everyone from UBS to Merger Market, they're raving. Jason, I want to know which startups are front in line, do you think, to be picked up by a larger company once Lena Khan is out of her spot?
The media, you know, businesses that are struggling typically need consolidation. So most people would say media businesses from Discovery to NBC, Comcast, you know, all of that area is ripe for some consolidation and some trading of assets because they're up against YouTube, they're up against TikTok, and the audiences have switched. And, it's not like the cable providers and the cable networks have any kind of monopoly on communication anymore.
Sure.
Therefore, they're struggling. And when you saw the Skydio buying Paramount and Shutter Redstone and all that, that went down, there were just a lot of people who would have bid on those assets previously who would not now because of the M&A.
Skydance.
Oh, sorry. I got Skydio on my mind. Skydance.
I just had to go verify that. I think it's a different company.
Different company. So, you don't have Amazon, Apple, Google, YouTube, bidding on entertainment assets in some major way.
Yeah.
You did have it happen with Amazon buying, they bought the folks who owned James Bond, right?
I know who you're talking about.
I can't remember the, it'll come to me in a moment, but there was MGM, thank you. And so, all of that consolidation needs to occur. These things are having a hard time living independently. So we saw Disney buy Marvel, Pixar, Star Wars, and a collection there. I think these things are fine for them to trade like assets because they all are going to pale in comparison to the time spent on TikTok and YouTube. So let people bid and trade them like trading cards for $5, $10 billion each. It's not a big deal
for those little things to get bought and sold, because more of them will get made. And the same thing will happen with the long tail of SaaS startups. Why not have, you know, let people buy these SaaS startups, let them buy marketplaces. Yeah. And, you know, in terms of, for me, somebody's in the comments saying, well, Jason wants liquidity. Of course I do. You know, the whole venture industry and startups is based on the power law and hitting an Uber or an Airbnb and them going public and you distributing shares. The other piece of it is Airbnb and Uber and Apple being able to buy smaller startups. And that's really hard to have happen. Uber bought Postmates.
For a couple billion. Yeah.
Yeah. So where is, like, why is Lyft and Instacart, why are those still independent? They're only independent because Amazon, Tesla, Waymo can't buy them. But right now in the autonomy space, why wouldn't Waymo, Uber merge? Why wouldn't DoorDash and Uber merge? Why wouldn't any of these Amazon buy Uber? I think there's three really obvious ones. Amazon, Tesla, Uber, and DoorDash. There's some combination there, and Waymo, of a deal to be had that would be unbelievable at unlocking value, not just for shareholders, but for society. Like if Amazon owned Waymo, or Waymo and Uber were together, or DoorDash, Waymo and Uber became a company, can you imagine? Or if Tesla and Uber teamed up, it'd be incredible.
I think that there's a lot of fun combinations we could come up with. I think, you know, Uber and Amazon is very interesting, but we're talking again about these relatively large companies. You did mention smaller SaaS startups. My question is there a functioning market post Lena Khan for a lot of Series A, B, C startups at a price that acquirers are willing to pay? Because I still think there's probably still going to be a gap between private market valuations and big tech willingness. And I'm curious how big of a gap that will be, how long it will take to unwind, and when we start seeing $50 to $100 million acquisitions en masse.
The great news is, you know, if you look at what a big company can do with a smaller company in terms of leveraging an asset, what Uber as a $150 billion company could do with Waymo as an example would be extraordinary, because they, as many cars as Waymo could make, they could put out on the streets. What Tesla as almost a $1 trillion company could do with the $150 billion Uber is extraordinary. Tesla could just make infinite cars and put them into the network, right? And the network is already there. So they wouldn't have to do that, you know, massive amount of work to build up a network of 150 paying customers a month or whatever Uber has right now. So there's just so many amazing opportunities there to accelerate. And the valuations work themselves out because you have competition. And so, you know, just take Elon and, you know, Dara looking at what's the opportunity here, or Dara and Sergey looking at what's the opportunity of Uber plus Waymo, or Amazon, you know, looking at, you know, is there anything with Lyft and DoorDash? If we bought Lyft and DoorDash and made our own competitor, would that go faster and better and cheaper for customers? And man, it would be incredible.
Oh my gosh. So not to be rude to Lyft, but it is interesting to see how a company that for a very long time was much closer to Uber in terms of valuation has now fallen off so far, because, you know, Uber's worth, Jason, I forget, 150, 160 billion.
Something like that. Yeah.
Something like that. I just pulled up DoorDash, 70.
Yep.
And then you pull up Lyft, 5.8.
Yeah.
Like Lyft is a dollar. It's free essentially.
Yeah. So why wouldn't it get tucked in somewhere? Just like, you know, Postmates got tucked into Uber, et cetera. And so this kind of consolidation would be, I believe, good for the market. It would then create DPI. It would shower that money back to LPs who would then invest in the next generation and just stop the logjam in venture. I see it happening already. If I'm being honest, in the last 6 weeks, I've had maybe 5 or 6 offers for shares in companies we own
that
we didn't take advantage of. But the fact that people are even bidding, and they aren't bidding 75% off, they're bidding 25% off. So we're starting to get to a place where secondary markets are showing some signs of life. I think that's directly correlated with the Trump presidency and the Biden, Kamala era, Lena Khan era ending.
So tell me about which types of startups in the launch or Jason portfolio are seeing the most interest from secondary market investors right now? I'm curious.
Ones that are growing. So if you have growth in, and you know, there are some companies that aren't growing, people are not buying shares in companies that are not growing, but there are companies that are either consumer or are SaaS companies that are growing, and there is interest in them. So somebody believes, if I have some dry powder, it's easier for me to buy this company that's valued at $1 billion and is doubling revenue year over year than it is for me to make an incremental bet on a public market company like NVIDIA or a startup that doesn't have product market fit yet. So that's a very interesting turn of events. That means people believe M&A will fire back up again. That's, or IPO market will be very open. So people are starting to see that and they're like, you know what? I should bid on, you know, there are vibrant markets for Anduril, Stripe, SpaceX, and those kind of big names.
Yeah. But
it's also starting to trickle down to the ones just a little bit smaller than those.
Okay. Now, Jason, we need to get on to Perplexity because we need to talk about search. But really quick for everyone else, crypto looking pretty hot. Trump made a lot of promises to the crypto world that may now come to fruition. Deregulation is a big point. On the other side, Jason, I think climate policy, climate industry, not looking too good.
Mm-hmm.
Chinese stocks took a bit of a hit after it became clear that Trump won. Companies that are dependent on the Affordable Care Act, like Oscar Health, got whomped. And then I'll say housing stocks, concerns about tariffs and rising labor costs. So Toll Brothers, et cetera, all pretty down sharply today. That's kind of mixed. Again, we're sorting this out. It's real time. Welcome to Jason and I chatting it through. But let's talk about Perplexity.
Okay. Really quick. Perplexity makes search software. And there's also, and they've raised a new round of funding at $9
billion. It's closing. Not quite done yet. Sorry.
Closing. Okay. So this round has been talked about a whole bunch. I think people are really jumping the fence on this one because I don't know how many paying customers they have. Has that number been whispered or leaked, Alex?
Yeah, so the Wall Street Journal in the reporting about this round, which is 500 at a $9 billion, said that last month, the company was on pace to generate around $50 million in annualized revenue. So that would put them at about a $4 million monthly run rate, Jason.
Okay, $50 million. Times 10 is 500 million, times 100 is 5 billion, times 200 is 10 billion. So this is almost 200x, correct?
Yep.
In terms of valuation. So that doesn't make a lot of logical sense to anyone. So you're really making a deep bet that they can catch up to that valuation. I think that Perplexity might have just hit its peak valuation. It's a really interesting UX product. But I think that UX is something that Sam Altman has his sights on. And if you do searches, and I asked you to do some, if we just pull up you searching for something on Perplexity or Search GPT, which is Sam Altman and OpenAI's new one, we can just look at this and you tell us which, maybe you could describe these three search results, Google 1.0, Perplexity, and OpenAI, and tell me what you think.
Yeah, so Jason put me four different searches. We're going to go through one today for the sake of time. So I ran a search for a travel-related query, which is flights from Rhode Island to Austin, just kind of keeping this in the Jason and Alex bucket. Google's search results were all ads above the fold when I was not logged in, which I thought was incredible. Just abysmal, Jason, in terms of user experience. Now, Perplexity actually did a pretty good job citing some different sources, giving some options. And I'll say that I think they did a pretty okay job. But I think when I look at this, I think I prefer the OpenAI Search GPT results. Gave me a very simple table, gave me some numbers, very clean interface. And I think this just goes to show that the Perplexity valuation is not predicated on its current worth, but instead the chance that it actually takes on and takes out a good chunk of Google market share. Because every share, every percent share of search is worth what? $100 billion, Jason?
Some very large number. You would take half of Google's market cap and you would attribute that as the 100% pie. Because half of it comes from search, at least. So if Google's worth, Alphabet's worth $2 trillion, you have $1 trillion as the total market cap, which means 10 billion per percentage point.
Okay, so I was off by a factor of 10, but the point is it's a lot. So all they need to do, Jason, just get 1% of search and Perplexity is all set.
This was my pitch when I did Mahalo and I was doing human-powered search. I do think probably a more fair search is this one, you know, flights from New York to Austin. So I just want to make this one point is that when you have a Google application. I'll call these applications. Some people might call them one box or whatever.
Sure.
When they do have an application and it comes up and they're not trying to intercept the click, so here is Google Flights, that is something they've been working on for decades per category. So for shopping and for flights, they and local, they have these kind of databases and tools that have unique data sources. It will take the AI companies some amount of time to replicate that.
Yes, I will say
1 year, though, 5 years, I'm not sure.
I will say, we're not going to go through the other three searches, but we ran one for shopping, one for research, and one for a cooking query. And I thought Google was the worst each time.
Oh, okay.
That
because of the ads above it. So it's pretty clear that the number of ads is the Achilles heel, I think, of Google. If you were to, because these new products don't have any ads in them. So I think a way to test this, and we'll do a deeper dive on this. I'm interested in the audience's opinion as well. If you were to take out the ads in Google and then do them side by side, what would your assessment be? Might be a better way to frame the question.
I'll just close with this. If I did that, I bet you lunch that I would still prefer what SearchGPT and Perplexity have. Because if you start from scratch without the advertising technology underpinning of Google, I think you just end up with a better product. But we'll keep that for another day. We have to go.
We'll see everybody next time. Bye-bye.